Want to talk about a new movie?
Check.
Want to talk about an older movie similar or related to that new movie?
Check.
That's what you can expect from Quality Check Podcast.
It's a new podcast on the Studio DNA Network, hosted by yours truly, Drew Douglas and
Daniel Posey. Every other Tuesday, we'll talk about a new movie and an old movie to see how the film's quality holds up.
Live from a bunker in the heart of the Ozarks, a podcast that isn't wizard or alien, but is part android, it's SIFPA. Welcome to SIF Pop Weekly, streaming live most weekends, are available to download later in your podcast feed. Unless, of course, you're a patron.
Patrons get those perks!
I'm your host, Aaron Dicer, and each week we'll chat about movies, TV, and whatever else from the pop culture universe is on our minds. And joining me this week, please welcome our guest. He's courageous, righteous, hopeful, and has mastered posing stoically. It's Jonathan Paula, ladies and gentlemen.
Thank you. Thank you very
welcome.
Much.
Thanks for
glad to be
back,
here.
Man.
Glad to be back. Yeah, absolutely.
Say
that with such surprise. Like, I'm surprised you came back after what happened last week.
Listen, just embrace the verbal
nerve
reality.
On this guy.
He walked in 5 minutes ago. I'm like, fine, we'll put you on the show. Speaking of people on the show, Andrew not able to join us this week, so we'll just be Jonathan and I, and we will be talking about Winter Falcon, as Jonathan calls it, instead
and
of saying
Shiva Baby
and the entire title. And yeah, Shiva Baby. We'll be talking about those for this week and excited to do so. First little catch-up time, Jonathan, since last month. How you been doing? How's life? How's everything going?
Still in quarantine, Aaron. Haven't really left the house.
I don't know. We're getting close. It feels like we're getting close. You know?
I've been having a good April. It snowed recently here in New Hampshire in the middle of April, which is
nice.
Always fun. I bought some bulk Lego off the internet that my daughter and I were able to play with yesterday. Just dumped out a big pile on the floor.
Great.
And I got a new movie poster for my office, which the people on the video feed can see right over my shoulder.
Yes.
So, like, some light decorating happening here in the Paula household. But otherwise, just same old stuff. Just taking care of my young girls and watching movies every night. And excited to talk about the shows and stuff we're doing today.
I will say, we just finished recording the Members Only pre-show, where we broke down some of the major Oscar categories and did some predictions and talked about what we wanted to win, what we thought should win, and what we thought will win for some of the major categories. So that'll be there if you're a SIFPOP member at patreon.com/SIFPOP, that conversation. And along with that, wanted to remind you that next week during the Oscars, we will be doing a live Oscar watch-along. We call it the Sposkers. And we have a great time doing that. Would love for you to join us. In addition to what's going on next week, there's a contest that happens when you make your Oscar picks. So if you want to like battle us and see if you can pick better than us on what you think are going to win the categories, which I believe are 23 categories now. Because
there's too many.
Well, they combine.
No one will ever get a perfect score. It's just you can't get all those little tiny categories. Best forward language short uploaded only in Hulu. Like, it's tiff to get these ones. Yeah. They can't get them all.
So the best ever has happened twice, and that's 22 out of 24. Two people have done that.
So really nobody – I was joking, but nobody has actually ever done
– nobody's ever gotten a perfect score. And we
run
have
the table.
Hundreds of people who try. So maybe that can be you this year, and it will be a little bit easier because – the sound categories are together, so there will only be 23. You only have to go 23 for 23 this year.
This I did not know. That is great because I never understood the difference. I do video production for a living.
I will say this. If you want to play, if you want to get your picks in and have fun with us next weekend on the Oscars, just do it now. Load up a browser right now. Go to sifpop.com and click on where it says Sposkers and just go ahead and do that now so you don't forget. I don't want you to miss out. It is coming up fast. Again, that is
unless you're listening to the podcast in your car and you're driving, in which case immediately pull over and
that's
then
right.
Do that.
That's right. Even if you're on the busiest expressway ever,
just
pull over.
Throw in the hazards. Just pull over.
You know, there are priorities in life. You got to do what you got to do. Get your Sposkers picks in. Again, that is sifpop.com. And then just click where it says Spossker's. So yeah, there you go. All right, well, let's get into it, my friend. We've got some fun stuff we're going to talk about today. In addition to Falcon and the Winter Soldier and Shiva Baby, we've, of course, got Best Ever Challenge, which is Best Ever Movies Featuring Babies. Of all different sorts, maybe? We'll see.
I am curious to see how you took this, because you give yourself a lot more rope than I try to. So I know for a fact you're going to have some oddball picks that just feature.
Listen, I even said it in the definition of the category.
You did.
It could be, you know, all sorts of different, you know, ways to interpret that. Yeah.
If anyone talks about a baby, if someone's
no.
half pregnant.
Okay, right? No. I have one movie. We'll get there. We'll talk about it when we get there. And then, of course, we've got our buried treasure as well. But let's go ahead and kick it off. Talk a little bit about Shiva Baby.
Danielle!
Please, Sonia!
Moira's here and our daughter Stephanie.
Jessica.
Whatever. You should really talk to her, you know?
No.
It's just a job.
Darling!
Hi, Mom.
I'm
so sorry for your loss.
No funny business with Maya.
Thank you.
You think everyone that's bi is experimenting? You have zero gaydar.
Excuse me, kid. I lived through New York in the 80s. My gaydar is strong as a bull.
You can't just, like, show up to, like, the after party for a Shiva and, like, reap the benefits of the buffet.
She lost so much weight.
Yeah.
You think she has an eating disorder?
I'm just your major again.
Sweetheart, feminism isn't exactly what I call a career.
It's not my career. It's a lens.
While at a Jewish funeral service with her parents, a college student has an awkward encounter with her sugar daddy and her ex-girlfriend. Shiva Baby is available on pay video on demand. You should be able to rent it or buy it. I think you can buy it. But this has kind of come out of nowhere, gotten a lot of buzz, a lot of people talking about it. I'm curious what you thought, Jonathan. Did you like it, love it, dislike it, hate it, or it was just okay?
I really liked Shiva Baby. I thought it was a very authentic, true-to-life drama filled with a lot of, like, good 20-something angst and anxiety. The performances were solid. The low-budget approach really worked. And I think if you have any experience with the Jewish community, the Jewish religion, if you are Jewish, certainly, this one hits home in a lot of really funny ways. This is a very funny film.
I think we're going to be on similar pages. I am straight up in the liked it camp. I wouldn't even say high side of liked it or low side of liked it. I liked this movie. And so much of it has to do with the two things that you mentioned. So let's start there since we're on similar pages. One of them being how funny this movie is. I guess we can start
really,
there.
It's definitely like the sort of in the moment humor. There's not out and out jokes. It's just situational comedy and situational awkwardness. And just when you add a bleak setting like a Shiva or a funeral or a wake, this sort of everyone puts up their own sort of facade as to how they behave and how they act.
Yeah.
And this movie kind of tears that down a bit and deconstructs like the behavior, the appropriate behavior at like a social function that is sad. And I think a lot of the humor is kind of pulled out of that, pulled out of her relationship with her parents. They're Jewish, they're overbearing. And it creates a lot of really great moments that I was able to relate to coming from a pretty well-established Italian family. So I've been to events like this where the only thing you can do all afternoon is just stuff your face with the hors d'oeuvres and the appetizers. Like, I just don't talk to me. I want to just be in the corner. Leave me alone. Anxiety's too much.
I hear you. The introvert that I am hears you loud and clear. The humor comes from such a specific place. And that's the other thing that you mentioned that I want to talk about is just how specifically authentic this is to, I mean, and I don't know because I will give you one guess as to how many Shivas I've been to, and the answer is zero. You guessed correctly.
Yep.
But it seems like such a specific thing that I am all of a sudden completely understand.
Yeah.
The very Jewish nature of what's going on here. I have seen that in other bits and pieces of pop culture from Jewish writers, Jewish creators. But here it just feels so deeply authentic that the humor just feels so real and so funny. And I think that is why more than anything this movie works is because it takes And you've heard it said so many times, and it's so true. It takes such a specific viewpoint, worldview, and doesn't shy away from the specific things that we may not have known, we may not have understood, but when you show them to us, we go, oh, I get what it might be to be a human in that specific instance, because you're not trying to dumb it down for me. You're just showing me what it's like. And man, I really love it when a movie can capture that like this movie does. I feel like I've been to a Shiva now. I really feel like I've been to one, you know.
Oh,
in some
absolutely.
Ways.
This is one of those like fly on the wall experiences.
Right.
And actually, in many respects, not really fly on the wall. You're sort of in the head of our main protagonist. And in some cases, to the degree that the music and the editing and the ratcheting close-ups makes you feel as anxious and as uncomfortable as she is. Mm-hmm. And it's like, I just leave the room, please. These people are overbearing and I don't want to be like, you feel as anxious as she does in some of these sequences, which is great. But everything you said about the authenticity and the world building and that sort of transportational empathy machine mm-hmm. aspect of this, where you really feel like you're in the shoes, you've really walked a mile.
Yeah,
in this community, a lot of that has to go down with the director Emma Seligman,
mm-hmm.
And she is this story. Like she is a young 20-something bisexual woman brought up in a Jewish family outside mm-hmm. of Boston, and like everything about her story, everything about her personal experience is in this picture, and you can feel it. Like she wrote what she knew. This is what she knew, and that is why I think so much of this works really well.
Yeah,
is because of how authentic this feels and how believable and realistic this entire experience is, because this probably happened to her like beat for beat.
Yeah,
maybe not with like as much big moment drama, but like this is clearly pulling from some real stuff.
One of the other things I want to talk about is the difference between the humor in this that I think could be rightfully called cringe humor. There are moments where it's just like, I can't believe this is happening. And the idea of cringe humor as we know it, maybe thinking something like Borat or something like that, I think that's an interesting distinction to make here, because I talk about not liking cringe humor, but here I love it, but it's because it's so authentic. It's the type of cringe that you're like, oh, that's what it means to be human, not, oh, you did a crazy thing that's just way over the top and now, you know.
Right.
And I think that's an interesting distinction to make, and one that I think, for me, determines my ability to find my way in, my ability to empathize,
right.
Because of that authenticity. Did you find yourself cringing? Did you find yourself kind of in that same situation?
Oh, but but in a good way. It
right,
was like
yeah.
I felt the uncomfortability and I felt the cringe, but in a way that I was able to enjoy it secondhand. And there's so many great moments in this, little glances, looks across the room, where we feel like the sting of jealousy that she does, but in a way that
mm-hmm.
is amusing, you know, because we kind of get it. And perhaps also owed to the fact that you and I are way older than, like, I think she's only 20, 21 in this movie.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And she's going through a lot of that, like, post-college aimlessness that I think a lot of people do. Like, what am I going to do with my life? And that's a big
right.
focus of this narrative, is her overbearing parents. What is she going to – is she going to stay with her ex-girlfriend? Does she want to pursue this other guy, that her
right.
sugar daddy character? And yeah, a lot of that angst and uncertainty that drives all of her emotional decisions in this were very relatable.
Mm-hmm.
And I instantly felt like an anxious 20-something college grad again.
Yeah.
And just placed in a situation with my parents where, like, well, what do you do for a living? Like, I'm a professional YouTuber. Don't make me explain it. It's very, like, you know what I mean? Like, I was there all over again. And it's like, oh, so you do things on the internet? Like, how do you make
right.
money from that? Like, oh, I have an idea you can do. It's like, please don't give me your unsolicited video ideas. I do not. Like, oh, you're a writer? Here's a book idea. Like, no, you write 70,000 words. I got stuff to do.
Yeah.
And I think we've all had that experience at one point in our life. And this movie sort of encapsulates that, the cringe, that embarrassment. But it leverages it in a way that made it really funny
mm-hmm.
and genuinely entertaining. And perhaps more than anything, the pathos of that was very real. And I feel like you kind of go through this movie being like, I kind of felt what she did in a good way.
Yeah. Yeah. I totally agree with everything you're saying. I also want to talk about the performances in this, because I think they're so solid. And I don't think the authenticity sells as well as it does without people like Polly Draper and Fred Melamed and playing the parents. And I like
Fred
I
Melamed
just...
is great. We just saw him in WandaVision.
Mm-hmm.
He played Vision's boss.
Right.
And he's one of those that guy faces, like, mm-hmm. oh, that guy, I know him. And I had to look up his name. I've seen him in probably 100 projects, TV shows, and movies over the years. And he's fantastic. He's like quintessential, like New York borough, like old Jewish guy. And there's something about the authenticity that he brings that, like, yeah, he is exactly this character in a great way. Rachel Sennott as Danielle, our protagonist in this, she was so good.
Mm-hmm.
And so much of her performance is internalized. A lot of it is just like glances and feelings and that anxiety when she reads a text message that, like, she knows is going to screw up her whole day. She was really good. And this is the first thing I'd ever seen her in, certainly. I don't know if she has done other projects. Her filmography on Wikipedia is pretty sparse. She was in the short film version of Shiva Baby a couple years ago, and this was adapted from that. And like a couple TV credits, but nothing that I've seen. So
no, this is definitely her break onto the scene. Yeah. And I think from this movie, they've already been signed for, you know, to make a couple movies for someone. I say they, I mean the director and Rachel as well, kind of working together. That was my understanding of. I could have gotten that wrong, but
great for them, because I think this is exactly the type of sort of entry point directorial debut, low budget feature that, like, more indie filmmakers need to try to do. Like, I see so many, especially on Netflix, greenlights them all the time, where they try to go big with these huge ideas and these concepts that they're just not ready for as a younger director. They don't have the ideas. They don't have the experience. This was, like, a very small scale, small budget. It takes place nearly in real time inside just one building, one ceremony of Shiva, and over, like, 2 or 3 hours. And with maybe, you know, a central cast of 5 or 6 and then, like, the background players of another 20. And that's it. Like, you probably could have made this movie in a couple of weeks on maybe a couple $1 million. And the result is just so perfect, because they didn't try to go big with this concept in a way that they could have expanded it out or added other elements to it. They kept it small scale. And I think when you do that, you can get better results instead of trying to sort of maybe punch beyond your weight class.
Yeah, there are two aspects to that I wanted to touch on, and one of them is just what you talk about, the fact that this is in...
And in fact, the budget was only $225,000, actually.
And that doesn't surprise me.
Super cheap. Super cheap.
Because it's very much a bottle episode kind of feel to it, right? Like, it is, and I wasn't necessarily expecting that, but that's hard to do sometimes, too. And the fact that the movie maintains the intensity and there's tension here... Like, actual narrative plot tension, and that tension doesn't let up. The other part of that I wanted to mention was, a lot of times I'll see, especially in the horror genre, when a short film...
I didn't want to single it out, but horror and sci-fi, I think, are probably the two worst offenders of first-time directors trying to do something much bigger than their budget or their experience allows.
Right.
And it's like, do something really small that you can do well, and then do it really... Like, Kevin Smith in Clerks is a great example. He had, like, no budget, like, no actors. He just uses actual friends. And Clerks was a huge success. And then he parlayed that into these other movies much bigger. And that kind of worked for him until it didn't. But this, I think, is a good example of, like, yeah, this is how you get your start in Hollywood. $220,000, it sounds like a lot of money to simpletons like us. But in Hollywood, that's extremely cheap.
Oh, yeah, for sure. Yeah,
and
I was.
This worked.
I was thinking of... Lights Out, was that the name of the movie? I think there was a horror movie called Lights Out that started as a short film. And this has happened to me many times with horror movies that start as short films. I feel like it should have stayed a short film. I feel like they didn't have what it took, whatever that is, to build it out. And it just felt like a one-trick thing that didn't work for 90 minutes. It may have worked for 10 minutes, but it didn't work for 90 minutes. And that's hard to do. So I think level of difficulty here is another thing to praise, because they apparently did take something that worked for 10 minutes and made it absolutely 100% work for 90 minutes.
This is actually only 77. It's kind of on the
short side.
But, 77 but that's, I think that's okay, though.
Yeah,
like,
of course.
If you don't have them, like, don't stretch the script another 15 pages if you don't have that content.
Right.
Like, don't just like fill it out for the sake of hitting arbitrary run times. Like, you qualify for awards and feature length at 40 minutes in most markets. 40 minutes is qualified as a feature. So, like, yeah, get your 40 minutes and then call it a day. Like, you don't have to make it artificially longer if you don't have the story to back it up. And this movie, I think, was perfectly paced. It was just as long as it needed to be. And it ends on a fantastic gag.
Fantastic.
Everyone piling into a minivan. And it's just one of those things, you kind of shake your head like, oh my gosh, what is...
Yeah.
Like you're just sort of, again, your like secondhand embarrassment runs through line this entire picture in a good way.
It's great. I do want to mention before we close out, I'll make this my one last thing. And if you have anything else you want to talk about, we can do that before we close it out. Mention Fred Melamed. I actually have known about him for a while because he got his start in voiceover. Big voiceover guy. And so I knew him from that. And then even more recently, he was in the movie In a World.
I was going to say he actually plays a voiceover guy in Lake Bell's movie In a World.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. So,
which is a really cute movie. I don't think a lot of people have seen, but it's a movie about voiceover artists.
Mm-hmm.
And it's funny. It's good.
It's really good. And then Diana Agron, I've seen before. I watched Glee, and I know she was on Glee, and so I had seen her before as well. So I'm glad to see her getting some work too. Do you have anything else?
My one last thing would be the music from Ariel Marx. A lot of it felt like a good horror movie, and I think that was deliberate. There were scenes where the protagonist Danielle is being surrounded by more and more people, and they keep asking her, "Oh, what did you major in? What's your job going to be like? Oh, who are you dating?" And it's just like she doesn't want to answer any of these questions. And the music ratchets up that tension with like all these really these sharp strings, and it was good, like an anxiety-inducing experience. That my wife literally turned to me and said, like, I'm sweating right now. This is making me uncomfortable.
I'm so glad we got there because I remember having the same thought that this is the most non-horror movie I've ever seen.
Yeah,
like it
right.
It feels like it really has all the trappings of a horror movie and the emotion, the tension, you know, from the best suspense movies.
And like a couple extra shots of like a Melamed in the bathroom, like plugging into a green tube or something, or like opening up out of a pod, like in Invasion of the Body Snatchers. And this is a horror movie. Like just a couple shots where it's established the parents are aliens, and you're like, whoa, this is really scary.
Yeah.
Obviously, they're just Jewish. They're not monsters or anything, but like that, they get so close to putting that into your head, like she hates everyone.
Yeah. I lied. I have one more thing. Because it strikes me that I need to talk about how much I appreciated the message and thematics of this as well, because there is a coming of age angle in this movie that has been in other things, but it's done so well here. Of the, I think I don't know who I am. I'm trying to figure out what it means to be me. All these adults already know who they are. But then you realize, no, even the adults are still trying to figure out what it means to be them. And this movie very specifically allows her the revelation of, oh, everybody is faking their way through this in some way or another. And
they kind of clown on the parents a couple times. Like the car has a bunch of extra stuff in the back because he was going to sell it or paint it or do something. And he clearly does not have his stuff together. He's unprepared. I really enjoyed that sort of thematic aspect of it.
Yeah, it's good stuff. Shiva Baby, is a recommend from me. Again, it is PVOD. If you want to check it out, you can. All right, let's move on to Falcon and the Winter Soldier.
Superheroes cannot be allowed to exist. I have no intention to leave my work unfinished. The world's upside down right now. Where do we start?
Falcon and the Winter Soldier are a mismatched duo who team up for a global adventure that will test their survival skills as well as their patience.
What a thoroughly unthorough pitch line. It does not tell you anything about the show.
Well, I was just gonna say,
but let's be honest, this is Marvel. You know already if you're gonna watch it because you've already watched it. This is not, nobody's making decisions on Winter Falcon, as I'll keep calling it because it's so much shorter. No one's making decisions to watch Winter Falcon based on the summary or the trailer. It's just, oh, I'm in. Like, I was in as soon as they greenlit this 2 years ago.
Yeah. As soon as they put the Marvel logo at the front, it was something that I was going to watch. I feel like you could pretty much just throw any tagline from the Lethal Weapon movies and it would work for
for even made that connection, but I love it. This actually absolutely feels like a good sarcastic buddy cop comedy at its best scenes. There's definitely plenty of it where it doesn't.
Yeah.
But I think the central relationship between Bucky and Sam is what makes this so fun. And I think what makes the actual action work is that they are this sort of frenemies, this contentious teamwork. They don't really like each other. They don't really trust each other, but they keep saving each other. They keep helping each other. There's definitely like a good animosity to their allyship that makes things interesting and certainly really fun.
So let's set some ground rules here before we get to the like it, loved it, dislike it, hated it, or was just okay. We are through the first five episodes of The Falcon and the Winter Soldier.
Which is just one shy. There's only going to be six total.
Correct. So because of the Oscars next week and some movies coming out and playing catch up, we figured we'd talk about it now, not having seen the finale. How is that going to impact our feelings on this show? Maybe a little bit, but I don't think a lot. I think we can still have this conversation. The only things that may impact our feelings are resolutions, if we feel like, you know, if it sticks the landing or doesn't stick the landing, whatever that means.
That to me is big. That could change my opinion a couple of points in either direction.
Here's the thing, though. Here's what I learned after WandaVision, and maybe there will be a Marvel show that isn't like this. I don't expect it from Falcon and the Winter Soldier. I don't think these shows are landing. I mean, they are finishing some series of events, but they are so forward pushing to the movies that I think to expect them to answer big questions to, you know.
I think without spoiling anything, and of course we can't because we haven't actually seen episode six, this show is going to end exactly where it began.
Right.
And I think that has to be sort of a complete circle. Where we last left off before the show with Bucky and Sam, the Falcon and the Winter Soldier, Captain America had just bequeathed his shield, the symbol of American freedom, to Falcon. And at the start of the show, like the first scene, he gives it away to the Smithsonian. And I have to feel like the show ends with him sort of not only getting it back like physically, but also getting it back like emotionally, like he finally accepts, this is my role. This is the mantle I'm going to take up. I wasn't ready six episodes ago, but that's his arc.
We'll get into it more. The other ground rule I wanted to lay is the spoiler thing about this. As Jonathan said, I do believe if you are going to watch this, you're probably already watching it. And so it is something we aren't going to, the same we did with Wanda. When we reviewed Wanda on this show, we did not worry about spoilers. We assumed that those who wanted to watch it were watching it. Having said that, if you do not want to hear, we're not going to be like ultra go through every plot line spoilers, but we will be aware of events that will be better in reveals as they happen during these five episodes. If you have not watched Falcon and the Winter Soldier and you want to be surprised by those things,
we probably already said too much. I keep talking out of turn. I'll let you keep going there.
You can jump ahead because we aren't going to keep ourselves from talking about some of the major points in these five episodes that make the show what it is or what it is not. Now let's do it. Did you like it, love it, dislike it, hate it, or it was just okay? Jonathan, where are you at after five episodes?
I definitely liked it, really like it, but not anywhere close to loved it. I don't know how big that chasm is between like it and love it, but I am...
Well, you said I really liked it, but not anywhere close to loved it. I didn't realize there was that much of a span in the categories.
As soon as I said it out loud, I realized, no, that doesn't make any sense. So I'll put it in the middle of liked it.
Firm liked it. I am on the high side of liked it, maybe even on the low side of loving it. I'll start here. The interesting thing about this show is it is exactly the show that I believe people who didn't like what WandaVision was doing will love. This is the show Absolutely. That you thought Marvel was going to give us. Yeah. And in fact, this show or a show like this probably would have been first in a different universe where the pandemic doesn't happen. WandaVision
leading off with WandaVision was a curious but understandable choice given the sort of production issues with COVID. But yeah, this feels like a typical Marvel movie stretched out to 6 hours.
Right.
This has your humor, your action, and your sort of character beats that slow things down. And you're weaving in a little bit of that like lore of the other things that we hear about other characters. We bring in Zemo from the Civil War movie. That villain sort of has a Hannibal Lecter style return. And we bring in some characters from Wakanda and the Black Panther franchise. So there's a bit of like interweaving between different properties that I think we didn't get as much of in WandaVision, at least like with the main, with Wanda, I mean. We got like some of these ancillary tech guys, and we got, what's her name, Darcy. I forget her name. And the other guy.
Yeah.
No, the guy with the cards.
I know who you're talking about.
What's his name? I can't remember. I can't remember any actor's name right now. But yeah, you know what I mean.
The part about WandaVision, you know, that was, what is this? This is strange. This is weird. And, you know, one of the main reasons I love that show and continue to think that was just incredible TV. For a lot of people, it was a bit too much. But I think they're getting what they want here. And I get it. Marvel is clearly not pinching pennies on the action on TV. They're clearly making incredible spending money on visual effects and all that kind of stuff. So they're giving it to us. And I think if that's what you want and what you were expecting from these TV shows, I think you're getting it here. And that is one of the primary reasons I'm having a good time too, is because I do. I like it. I like this world. I like these characters. I like the chemistry between these two. I think it's great. I think the show is moving to some interesting places. It definitely has a point of view. It is definitely a show about, you know, racism as it is applied to nationalism and the idea of wrestling with the demons of your country at the same time as you want to, you know, embrace your country. Like there's a real that we're all having to do, but especially a person of color who is dealing with what it means to be America. What does that really mean?
Yeah. How do you, I think that's been one of the most interesting sort of character threads, and certainly one of the most interesting subplots is Anthony Mackie as the Falcon, as Sam, struggling with how do I accept the responsibility and the symbolism of being Captain America with the idea of that. That's ultimately why he rejects it in the beginning, I think, is how do I accept that responsibility while being a black man in a country that doesn't like me?
Yeah.
That constantly maligns my race. Like how do you reconcile a country, defending a country you love when it's filled with people that hate you?
Filled with inherent deep bias that is going to, you know, take a long time, if ever, to excise, you know, like that's just, it's built into the foundation in many ways. So, yeah.
And I love that Marvel is going down that route. And I don't want to say they're going political. That's such a stupid phrase that carries no meaning to me. Like political is, it's comic book. They're all political. They all have politics involved. But like being so overt with the sort of tackling of racial and social issues that are very prevalent and very important today, and actually just bringing them right to the forefront and to contextualizing them with the shield as like, this is the symbol of American freedom. What if it was literally and figuratively stained in the blood of people that we had imprisoned and enslaved? Like that is a very interesting dilemma for a character that's black in, you know, 21st century America. And they tackle it head on here, which I was not expecting. I thought this would just be like fun jokes and punches, and we get plenty of that.
Sure.
But there's some deeper stuff here that I think, especially in episode 5, I would say I was maybe not lukewarm, but I was enjoying the show to an average degree. Episode 5 was a big slowdown. It opens with action, but then like 45 minutes straight is like character building. We get some nice montages and we get a lot of introspection. And I loved everything in the 5th episode to a degree. Like I instantly was like, okay, I'm on board now.
Yep.
I didn't really care. I knew where the show was going and I wasn't really interested. Now I'm like fully on board and I'm so much more invested in just that entire story with Falcon and like what is going to happen to him and how that'll affect him and his family. Whereas I don't know that I cared before episode 5.
Yeah, my journey has been loved it after episode 1. I think just the fact, listen, Marvel has an unfair advantage here. Can we be honest? Yep. They just have an unfair advantage. They have over a decade of an emotional investment in the story that they continue, the serialized cinematic story that they continue to tell. They have
12-year TV series.
They have the ability to bring Don Cheadle off the bench for 5 minutes. Like, how do you do that? You know what I mean? Like, that's just insane. And I was loving it.
And they have the budget in the first episode. Correct. The show opens. I almost called it a movie. The show opens with like this aerial aerial fight over, I think, Afghanistan or Libya.
Yeah.
And it's like a 12-minute cold open that rivals the best action scenes in any feature-length film. And I'm like, this is a TV show. Who are you trying to impress? You must have spent $6 million on this first 12 minutes alone. And I think the entire six episodes, I want to say, cost them $150, $200 million.
Yeah.
This was an expense, like, minute for minute, as expensive as Game of Thrones and the old shows on HBO like Rome or Carnival.
But not
quite. This is pricey.
Not quite as much as Amazon is apparently going to spend on the first season of Lord of the Rings. Did you see that?
I heard something about
465 million.
Yeah, I was going to say 400, right? Like, that's what? That's the GDP of several African countries.
Yeah, yeah.
Probably European ones too. Like the big ones. Like, how much does France make in a year?
So
less than Marvel.
So by episode two, I'm still in love with the show. I think the things it does early on in this series with Bucky and him wrestling with his own demons is really powerful, and they don't shy away from that. And, you know, maybe not just as much as what Sam is going through, but Bucky is also dealing with his own, personal things that he has done. So there's a difference between, a bias that is integrated into you or your country or those kind of things, and then the actual actions you take. And Bucky is wrestling with that.
Yeah, I think it's been so fascinating to see a black guy that has been, we haven't seen like direct issues of Sam dealing with like racism. It's definitely implied, and we see it with other characters and we hear about it. Teaming up with a guy that is like the literal personification of imperialism. Like, the Winter Soldier was a white man brainwashed, sent to other countries to impose America's will. Like, he is literally like the definition of imperialism as a person.
Right.
Like a brainwashed agent of America, just like the government complex. Just, we have to go to other countries and take them over and imprison. And like,
right.
And somehow they turn this character into like a really empathetic and interesting guy who you want to root for to overcome all of that baggage as he searches for meaning of, like, can I even reconcile what I've done? Can I make amends for all these things I've done?
Yeah.
And his character and his plot has been really fascinating as well.
So episode one, episode two, totally on board. Love it, love it, love it. Episode three, I wasn't in. I was just like, I think it's the Zemo prison break and that kind of stuff. And I was like, I get what's going on here, but so much of it didn't make sense to me. I still don't understand how they got Zemo out of prison.
They really glossed right over it.
I still don't understand why the Winter Soldier, specifically Bucky, would want to get him out of prison. Like, I mean, all the stuff the show is trying to do after the fact with the Wakandans, you know, making sure that Zemo is taken care of or whatever. It shouldn't have been necessary. The show never convinced me that the Zemo part was necessary. I'm glad. I love the three of them together. They're fun.
He brought so much more humor than I was expecting. He was a very funny character.
I didn't have any buy-in. All of a sudden it became more point A to point B. Then you've got episode four, and it's more point A to point B that feels rushed. The whole thing with the Wyatt Russell character, John Walker,
the new
Captain America, where he ends at the end of that episode, you know, standing over the dead body with the blood on the shield or whatever, and it's just that
moment worked, but it was so
it wasn't it earned was so, though. Like, he, how did he get there? Like, I mean,
Well, it, to me, it felt so telegraphed. Like, oh, yeah. Good. Evil Captain America did something evil. We all knew he was gonna. Like, there was nothing.
But the show never sold us why he turned. Like, you know, like, I get it. It winks at his pressure and how the pressure of the shield weighs on him. But there's just, I don't know. It didn't quite work for me. And then
I think Wyatt Russell's doing a great job as evil Cap for you know, easier parlance, just evil Cap. But I don't think he's a very interesting character. He's just
right.
He's brought in, and it's like, okay, we're obviously not going to like this guy. He's not Chris Evans. He's not the old Captain America. So right off the bat, he's playing with a deficit. And they try to establish him as like a good guy with medals of honor and Purple Hearts or whatever. But like the whole time we're going, you're not my Captain America. I don't care about you.
Right.
And they try to engender him onto the audience. But by the end of the fourth episode, when he turns into this super evil, like kicking the puppy bad guy, it's like, yeah, okay, I knew that was coming. Of course he's not good. He's not Chris Evans. And there was no arc because like I knew he was bad. And
correct.
Then they tried to trick us and it didn't work and he ended up bad. Okay.
So
what was the moral of that?
We agree on parts
maybe
of
we'll
that.
Find out in the, yeah, maybe we'll find out in episode 6, but I have been very, very tepid on him.
We agree on parts of that, disagree on parts of that. We agree that there is no character arc with this character. And I think that's the largest problem is it just doesn't feel like there is a middle to the beginning and the end that they're trying to lay out before us. I actually believe unlike what it sounds like you believe, that Marvel's intention was for us to not like him from the beginning. But they were also simultaneously laying the groundwork of maybe, possibly, he's a good guy.
Do you think we were supposed to love him from the jump?
No, I think we're supposed to hate him from the jump.
Right.
Right, yeah. I think straight from the shot from below that emphasizes how terrible that costume looks on him! that they were
sending these big floppy ears. It
you
just
know,
did
and
not
it's
look.
The but it's the it, Chris Evans also had like the stick out ears on that costume. That costume does that to the ears. I don't understand the aesthetics there. But anyway,
don't be speaking ill of Chris's attractiveness now.
Just saying there are a few men that could make that. Could do that, but no, I think right from the beginning they're trying to let us know that something is off. You know, so I don't think they're trying to sell us. That he's great. I just think that they're underlying it with they're trying to create some sort of tension that you're right, just isn't there. We know where this is going.
Which I think is ultimately why he wasn't interesting to me. Like arc, his character, I know that he's just getting in the way of what will eventually happen. And for me, especially over 6 episodes and not a 2-hour movie, I'm kind of like, all right, can we get him out of the way and get on to the next part?
Yeah.
And a good deal of, I think, my frustration with his character is impatience. But episode 6 will kind of tell us if that impatience was warranted or not. And so far, I feel like, yeah.
So episode 3, I'm kind of out. Episode 4, I'm even more kind of like, okay, point 8. I was really feeling like we're at season 8 Game of Thrones in episode 4, where it's like characters are getting to the place they're supposed to be, but none of it is, you know, earned and it's just rushed and... And then we get to episode 5, and I'm just like all back. I love episode 5. I really enjoyed some of the stuff it did. I loved all the stuff it did with Sam. I loved the introduction of Julia Louis-Dreyfus.
Idea. I'm just excited that she's in it. Because if it's any other character, if it's any other actress, or I should say maybe not any other, but if it's a smaller actress, like a smaller name, it's just, okay, that's interesting. But because they get like a 7-time Emmy winner – like Julia, it's like, okay, immediately this is important. I need to pay attention. What's happening? What are they setting up? It's too late in the show to do anything big. So is this going to feed into a movie? Or is this
absolutely
be like,
100%. It has to.
I'm just like, okay, I don't know what you're planning, but because it's Julia, I'm on board. She commands a lot of authority. She walks in. We actually start the shot on her heels before it tilts up. Mm-hmm. And it's like, oh, snap. You got the girl from Seinfeld. I'm interested now.
And she's so good in that scene, and I'm excited to see where it goes to. I guess her character was supposed to be introduced in Black Widow, in the Black Widow movie.
Interesting.
So because this originally was supposed to be after Black Widow.
Yeah, right.
So So yeah, it's just it's going to be fascinating. But I'm all the way back in, and honestly, I feel like episode 6 will land it enough to kind of continue the Marvel juggernaut on. I'll still be very interested in where things are going. There'll be a big revolution. We all know what's in the case. You know, I don't need to see it. I know what's there. I can't wait to see it. It'll be exciting.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, they've got me in the palm of their hand on that one. Like, I just,
they know they do too.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and I just, feel like
$7.99 a month. They know they do.
I just feel like they're going to do the same thing. They're not going to land the ship. The ship is going to continue to rocket to the next thing, and I'm on board. Like, I, you know,
yeah, right.
I'm staying on the rocket ship, man.
A couple quick things here. Some questions and theories. Do you think they will re-edit Black Widow from its original version a year ago?
Yes.
To better account for the fact that we've already been introduced to some people?
Yes.
What would have been an introduction is now sort of a revisit. So they're going to change maybe how that was done.
I believe so.
And second question, if I can remember it now, let's see. The second thing you mentioned was the going into the next project, setting up everything in Marvel is setting up the next thing, right? We can't ever just end a movie without setting up the next one. My question is there anything Marvel could do that would derail that train?
Yes.
If they've released a turd smelly enough, would we all be like, all right, that's it. We're not going to watch the next one.
No, they've earned one turd. earned at least one turd.
Besides Thor 2.
But, you know, I mean, Pixar released Cars 2, right? Like, I mean, you get one or two. But what they would have to do, I think, is to... I don't know how to say this other than I think a lot of this has to do with the shepherding of the content, and Kevin Feige is a huge part of that. And I don't mean to sound like he's the only reason this works, but I do believe if there was somebody else who stepped in and had a different
reason why it works.
But if somebody else stepped in and had a different vision for the overall storytelling it just didn't work as well, that's how the train derails. The train derails because the overall vision derails.
Well, let's say they pull a spider. The only way we don't need to go down this road too much longer, but it's an interesting thought experiment that they pull like a Spider-Man, right? Where they have one bad movie, nobody likes it. It's another like Thor 2, some weird esoteric thing that we don't care for. And then what they do is we're going to reboot it. We're going to do all new cast. We're going to throw away 15 years of all the multiverse.
I think it's over at that point.
If they tried to restart and reboot and recast like they did with Spider-Man 2 or the X-Men, that's where people are like, forget it. This is especially since we only lost, for all intents and purposes, two characters after Endgame, Iron Man and Captain America. Black Widow was gone, but still really getting another movie. And all these other characters are getting their own TV show. So I think it's full steam ahead. And now that one train is now an express of multi-different tracks, all headed in new directions. So even if you hate Winter Falcon, I think it's going to go.
Yeah.
It's going to be really successful. This movie the show is going to drive up subscriptions on Disney Plus. It's going to lead right into Loki in a few weeks. I can't wait. I'm excited for it. I think episode 5 did some really exciting stuff where we finally start to see sort of the wind down of that arc over these 6 episodes. And now we know where this conclusion is really headed. And that's exciting. I love things that end. The last episode of any show is usually one of my favorites because I just want some satisfying conclusion. Mm-hmm. And for so long, Marvel has been really reluctant to end anything with any finality. And to your point, I feel like they are going to just be like, they're not going to land the plane. They might touch down and let somebody jump off.
Did you feel like WandaVision ended?
We got like a really decent conclusion to sort of her arc vis-a-vis grief, right? Understood, like, she ended that arc.
Right.
But as a person, she ended up right back where she was. Plus, there's a vision. There's an extra vision floating around.
Right.
So, like, I think we'll get a resolution to the arc built in this show, which is Bucky will find amends with his past and Sam will find the courage to take up the title of Captain America.
Right.
But at the end of the show, the characters are going to be back where they started, part of the Avengers with their cool tech and their witty sarcasm, and they're going to be kicking bad guys, and there's not going to be anything to stop that from going. I think Marvel deliberately has been building these shows so that you can skip them and still enjoy the movies on a parallel track without – like, you don't have to know what happened in WandaVision to appreciate the next Doctor Strange film, I don't think.
Well, they've been doing that, though, the whole time, right? The whole time they've been trying to make, other than you could say Infinity War and Endgame, they have been trying to make Guardians of the Galaxy movies that you don't have to have seen any other Marvel movies to enjoy. I don't know who that person is that is just going to see Guardians of the Galaxy movies and not the rest of them, but they exist. I'm sure they exist.
Well, of course, because the box office returns for one is $3 billion,
right?
And then these other movies are down here in like 400 and 500.
Right.
Okay, so there's clearly six times as many people saw Endgame as did Thor 3 or Thor 2 or whatever.
Right.
So there are people that skip over projects, and I think Marvel is deliberately making these programs in a way that they're not integral to understanding where these characters are, but it's great backstory and extra filler for like the mid-season stuff.
And you have to look at the long game too. They have to continue to do that, or else new fans don't come along. In order for somebody, let's say somebody who was born 10 years ago, you know, is born after Iron Man has already come out. When they get to like movie watching, movie enjoying age, let's even say, you know, 11, 12, you know, that
it's
kind
daunting.
Of range.
There's
it's
hundreds, daunting. Not hundreds, it's dozens of hours of content.
It's like me trying to think, well, do I really want to go back and watch all the Sopranos? Do I really want to, you know, invest in this? I've heard it's amazing. It's great. So like if they don't bring new people in a way that can be like, no, it's okay. You can go back to that stuff if you want to once you're in, but watch this movie. This is going to be fun. Like they have to do that on a long-term scale, or they're setting themselves up for obsolescence when, you know, new younger audiences come in and just like, well, you know, and that probably will naturally happen anyway over time. There will be a bit of like, well, Marvel is my dad's thing, you know, or Marvel is my grandpa's thing.
That is a very interesting thought.
But I think
especially as long as Kevin Feige's in charge, we're going to see a sort of generational evolution with this franchise.
Mm-hmm.
That within the next 10 years, they're going to slowly recycle all the characters and bring in their replacements. Like this is probably the first big example of replacing the main six Avengers. That Anthony Mackie is going to de facto become Captain America at the end of this show.
Mm-hmm.
That's sort of a foregone conclusion. And I think that's really interesting. And eventually, we're probably going to see someone else in universe take over the mantle of Iron Man, or at least something very close to that, whether that's Rescue or War Machine or something. And I think they're slowly trying to figure out a way, how do we change our main characters in universe and recast, like a soft reboot in real time?
Mm-hmm.
Like you need it, like it's a mid-air refueling. And so far they're doing it really well.
Well, the other thing, you start to see why they spent so much money on Fox in that now they have the X-Men, Fantastic Four, to bring new life, you know, to this group. You know what I mean? So they now have two really big universes to be able to spring some life into what they're doing. It'll be interesting to see. And
we're at a part now where we're getting a new Marvel item every single week of the calendar year.
Yeah.
As soon as Winter Falcon ends this Friday, the week after is going to be a making of, and the week after that, Loki starts. And then when that's done in six episodes, I believe Black Widow comes out in theaters theatrically. Mm-hmm. And then after that, I think there's the next TV show, What If, or The Eternals, or whatever. Not The Eternals movie. There's a property every week. Every week they have something new.
Not only that, and over the course of a year, there will be seven Marvel movies come out. Not including the TV shows. Over the course of 1 year, from Black Widow to a year from Black Widow, there will be seven
insane
Marvel movies.
I did not know that. That is crazy. Because up until now, the most they had done was, I think, three in 1 year. It was 2019, I think. We got Ant-Man 2 and Infinity War and Captain Marvel, I think, all in 4 months.
Now, anything can change, but currently that's the plan to get back on track that way. So it's wild. It'll be interesting to see. But we've strayed a little bit from Falcon and Winter Soldier, but I think it's all appropriate conversation considering
what Marvel is
doing.
No, this is all good stuff. I was going to say, on episode 5, a specific point in the show I loved is the building the ship montage. It was just Sam and Bucky like working with their hands, having jokes, being friends, being cool dudes. And there's no threat. There's no bad guy. There's no ticking clock. There's no consequence. It's just two dudes hanging out, building a boat. And I was like, this is great. I want more hangout scenes, because some of my favorite moments in all the Avengers movies are when they're just hanging out. The scene where they try to lift the hammer in Age of Ultron is one of my favorites, because it's just, there's actually no one to fight.
Mm-hmm.
And they're just being people, interacting. And those are some of the coolest scenes in these movies and scenes in these TV shows, where we want to see these different characters interact like humans in realistic, down-to-earth, normal situations. It's cool that they can team up on the battlefield and take down Thanos, but like these smaller moments are some of the best, and I'm so glad we got that, a lot of it in episode 5, and I was so glad that episode 2 started right off the bat with them coming into the hangar together, because all of episode 1, they're in separate plots, in separate scenes, they never interact in the first episode, and I was really worried, like, is this going to be the Falcon and then also the Winter Soldier, or is it going to be the Falcon and the Winter Soldier? And I was really worried that, like, the whole show would just be them separately until the end. And thankfully, it was just that first 55 minutes, whatever. But the best stuff is when they're together, for sure.
Just hanging out, eating some shawarma, you know.
Yeah.
Just doing
stuff.
Like,
I love that stuff. Absolutely love it.
All right, we can move on. Obviously, I think we're both enjoying it. And can't wait to see how it resolves. Let's move on to the best ever challenge. Before we do that, though, just a reminder, if you want to be a Sif Pop member, lots of fun stuff going on over there right now, including our Oscar talk that I talked about recently. There is a weekly, when there is a show, there's a weekly bonus podcast for our Sif Pop members that you can listen to. If you want to be a member, it's patreon.com/siftpop. Also, that podcast feed where your bonus shows show up in doesn't have any commercials in the main shows either. You may have been hearing commercials as you listen to Sif Pop. It is one of the ways that we're able to support what we do here. But if you don't want to hear those, become a Sif Pop member, and you can do it that way as well. So go to patreon.com/sifpop, check out the different levels there, and thank you so much to our members for doing that. All right,
patrons get those perks.
They sure do.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Let's move on to the best ever challenge. Best ever baby movies. As mentioned, feel
free. Go ahead, read your list. Read your list of qualifiers.
Feel free to take this to mean movies that prominently feature a baby or babies. Movies that have baby in the title, or movies with a character named baby. I think those are the three primary ways something might be considered a quote-unquote baby movie. So let's go number 5 to number 1, and we will trump each other if we have it higher than the other person. Jonathan, go first. What do you got at number 5?
Baby Driver.
Me too! It's both of our number 5!
Super nice. Duper. this obviously qualifies both a character named Baby and Baby in the title. Super fun, kinetic, fast-moving action, kind of comedy. I remember being kind of funny. And the, just the editing and the style of this movie is very, very like music video.
It's a musical.
That is, I mean, to a degree that's intentional, right? There's music is woven, popular music is woven so tightly into the craft of this edit and into the plot of the movie. It's so much fun. I have to go back and rewatch this. I saw it like the week it came out, and I don't think I've seen it since.
Oh, yeah. It's a good rewatch. Really
but
is.
But really, really fun. And Ansel Elgort does pretty great stuff in the lead role in that one.
Yeah, it's a great movie. Edgar Wright has my number. I've talked about that before. I love how he thinks about movies. I love how he thinks about movie making. The musical aspect of this is elite. It's elite level filmmaking to be able to create a musical like this. So yeah, Baby Driver is my number 5 as well. Nice. What's your number 4?
Duper. Gone Baby Gone.
I will trump it, but just you know, briefly. So I'll go with my number 4, which you may trump. I don't know. My number 4 is Children of Men.
I would have had this at my number 1.
Yeah.
But I decided to include it in my honorable mention because while a baby is integral to the plot of the picture, it is not really about babies. It is about...
I mean, it kind of is.
It kind of is. I will allow it. I decided against it because the baby doesn't really factor in until near the end of the film.
Sure.
She's pregnant for almost all of it. But... gosh, what a brilliant picture. This is my favorite movie of 2006. Alfonso Cuarón directed, right? Cuarón, not Iñárritu? I always get them mixed up because they both do those long oneers. And Children of Men famously has a bunch of one-shots, or at least faux oneers that are stitched together with computer tricks.
One of them,
and they look gorgeous. They look physically impossible. Some of these shots go in and out of moving cars, and it's like, how did they do this? And the answer is with a great degree of difficulty.
I was going to say
such a good film.
The oneers in Children of Men are not completely oneers, but they are very close. So a lot of the stitching is only at the beginning and end. Like the car chase one specifically I'm thinking of, where they do come in and out of the vehicle, and so that's all done with camera. And it's just it's insane how they pulled that off.
And the story is just, it's such a fascinating, it's really good dystopian sci-fi. What would happen to Earth if the entire planet became infertile, if we had no future, if there were no more children? Like, we would lose all hope. There would be no point anymore. Everyone would just be super depressed all the time. If there was never going to be another generation, like, what is this all for? What is the point?
Yeah.
And this movie, I think, really well explores that. And this is your pick. I'll let you talk about it.
No, you said pretty much everything I wanted to say. I want to go back to the wonder thing, because I think a lot of times when people talk about these kind of things, I'll hear people use the phrase athletic filmmaking, and they almost use it pejoratively in some terms.
Yeah, right.
You know? And the idea of wonders being this thing like, oh, this little thing I can do because it's cool. And it's like,
it's definitely become showy. Like, oh, look how long mine is.
It can be, but in the right hands, it's done because of how much it increases things like tension, immersion. You don't realize how much you lose immersion when a movie cuts, because you know what doesn't cut? Real life. Real life doesn't cut. Maybe when you go to sleep at night, you could call that a cut. I don't know. I'm just saying, for the most part.
It's a slow dissolve.
Yes.
It's a slow fade to black. I totally get what you're saying. And there's a scene at the end where Clive Owen has to walk through like a burned out building past all these military guys with the baby, with the first baby born on planet Earth in 20 years. And because the camera doesn't ever cut, we never ever get a chance to like breathe or exhale. And the entire time, it's like, there's so much tension. You're just waiting, like, get out of the building safely. Like, I just want you to leave the building safely. And I'm so afraid for you right now. And the fact that the camera doesn't ever leave him, you get this, like, ratcheting sense of claustrophobia and tension. It's like, I cannot believe we're, like, it's a 12-minute shot or something by the end of it. And you're just so relieved when it finally cuts and he finally, it's like, oh my gosh, thank goodness.
Yeah. So, yes, fantastic. I get what people are saying when they talk about athletic filmmaking. However, there's a reason that some of these things are done, and I think Children of Men shows that. So, yeah, here you go. Great movie.
That was your number three or four?
That was my number four, so we're on to your number three.
This one, primarily, big-time baby film, Look Who's Talking.
Yeah.
This is such a fun picture. John Travolta and Kirstie Alley. Late, what is this, 1987, 88 when this came out?
And somewhere
Bruce
around
Willis
there.
Plays a talking baby. It's fantastic. This movie is just, it's a fun family movie. I rewatched it after my first daughter was born a couple years ago. And it doesn't hold up super well. Like, there's definitely, it's not a fantastic picture, but there's something so quaint and innocent and just fun. How about a movie where a baby talks like Bruce Willis? That's just that's a perfect pitch line.
That's all you need.
The baby, and it's voiced by Bruce Willis. I'm in. This is fun. And there's something, it works. I think it's a romantic comedy. They have great chemistry in this. They're a really good couple, and you want to root for them. And there's just sort of that disparate worlds of, like, he's a taxi driver and she's, I forget, like a waitress or something. Like, they should be mismatched. They don't really get along. It was like a one-night, he's not even the dad. He's like just a guy that helped. But he decides, I'm going to take care of this kid. I'm going to be the dad. I'm going to be your husband. And there's something about, taking responsibility for a little baby Bruce Willis that just kind of melts hearts. And it's a funny film.
When have you seen it? When's the last time you saw it?
Just a few years ago.
See, I haven't seen it since I was, really young.
Watching it as an adult, it definitely, all right, this isn't as hilarious I remember. But when I watched it as a kid, I thought it was fantastic.
Right.
And that it gets points for that. It is sort of an aimed at a lower audience. And I'll show this to my daughters when they're like 6 or 7, and they'll probably love it.
Yeah, I don't have enough familiarity with it to put it on my list. But I do remember it being a lot of fun. So I'm glad it was in my honorable mentions to talk about at least. So I'm glad you had it on there. Let's talk about Gone Baby Gone. That's what I have at number three. So sure. You had it at number four. I had it at number three. The quintessential go-to movie when I talk about moral conundrum movies. The idea of a movie that makes you walk out going, what would I do? And how long you process that. Gone Baby Gone is one of those movies. On top of the fact that it's really well made, really well acted. Again, we talk about Shiva Baby kind of being in a time and place and feeling authentic to the creator's worldview. Gone Baby Gone feels very much the same way. With how Boston it is, and
yeah, just... I was gonna say this is definitely a very Homer movie for me. Like this is The Departed, Mystic River, The Town. There was like a 5 year period between 2005 2010 where we just got a slate of like really not just movies shot and filmed in Boston, but movies that like felt Boston in a way that like were inseparable from the thread of the picture. That's one of the biggest things I remember about this movie is how well it sort of personified this area.
Yeah.
In a way that was authentic, but also a bit critical. And the characters all had like a really good, like flawed lived-in realism to them. And Casey Affleck is fantastic. He's always been fantastic.
Yeah, absolutely. So Morgan Freeman, Casey Affleck, and Ben Affleck, of course, announcing himself as a director to be reckoned with.
Yeah, for sure.
So yeah, Gone Baby Gone, definitely wanted to make sure it got on the list. Both has baby in the title and also prominently features a baby in the movie. All right, let's go to number twos, I believe. Is that right?
This is Three Men and a Baby.
This is another one I haven't seen in a while.
This is a same idea. The same week we brought our daughter back from the hospital, February 2018, we popped this in. This is, I think, the first movie we watched after she was born. And it was delightful to recontextualize it with that prism.
Sure.
Of like, okay, we're into this now. We're changing diapers. This is happening. We're not getting any sleep. Let's put on Tom Selleck and Ted Danson and Steve Guttenberg, right? Yeah. And it's a funny premise, like three bachelors who have no intention of settling down. They're just left with a baby from one of their one-night stands, and the mom has flown the coop. And now these three guys in their 30s, the bachelor pad in Manhattan, how do we take care of a little girl? And it feels like a great pilot for a sitcom that never got produced. Like it's like the it's the perfect setup for like a long-running sitcom, especially with Ted Danson and Steve Guttenberg. Like these guys, Ted has been a television mainstay for 35 years now. And this, I'm surprised this didn't get option for a TV show because it's such a fun premise. And I guess ultimately Full House was that, right? Three guys taking care of girls.
Yeah, you're right.
But this is really, if you like Full House, you'll like this movie. And it's funny. It's quirky. Just a lot of antics about these guys. Like how do they dress them? Where are the diapers? Like we don't understand anything. They're just completely unprepared. And there's just a really sweethearted experience. And I really dug it.
Nice. My number two is Roma. I've talked many times about how much I love this movie. Baby does feature prominently into this movie in a way that I think is the crux of what this movie does with our lead character. Man, I don't know what else I have to say about this movie other than I totally understand if somebody can't find their way into this movie. I get that a lot of what is happening here is very... very personal to the director and very personal to what's going on. Once it clicked with me, it moved me in the way that few movies ever have. And not only that...
I've heard you talk about this film before, and I'm pleased that you have such an experience. I didn't, ultimately, and this is one of the few pictures I think you and I have disagreed with on more than a couple of points, I should say. But hearing you talk about it is just like, that's fantastic. I love when I have that experience after a pitch.
Yeah.
I didn't get it from Roma, but I understand why you did. And there are some really powerful scenes in that film. The one at the beach is like, oh my gosh.
Yeah.
You're just gutted and you're just like in a ball of knots for the entire 3 minutes, whatever.
Yeah. I could talk often about thematically what Cuarón is doing here. By the way, second Cuarón movie on the list. And in fact, if it was going really abstract, I could put Gravity on here because that movie is very much about birth, though it's never explicitly about that.
I think that's definitely sort of a thematic.
Oh, for sure. Yeah, with her floating around with the umbilical cord. It's very much about birth. But anyways, I didn't go that far. But he definitely plays with the idea of parenting, birthing, all that stuff in his movies. It obviously means something very deep to him. Roma comes in at number two for me. Which brings us to our number ones, my friend. What do you got at your number one?
The 1938 screwball comedy with Katharine Hepburn and Cary Grant, Bringing Up Baby. This movie is a laugh a minute. And at 102 minutes, that's a century of laughs right there. I think people are maybe hesitant or afraid to get into older pictures. 1938, black and white comedy. How relevant? How funny could it still be today, 70-something years?
It's pretty funny.
Extremely funny. This movie is fantastic. It's hilarious. And if you're afraid or trepidatious about going into an older movie in this genre, this, I think, is a great, like, first step. Like, watch this, and, like, I cannot imagine you leaving this picture without some appreciation of how funny and how paradoxical some of the moments are. This feels like the best moments of a sitcom.
Mm-hmm.
It's just fast. The dialogue is really fresh and witty. And it's one of those things where, like, all these moments are happening simultaneously, and they all kind of, like, it's a pile of coincidences. I mean, that's sort of the essence of any good screwball comedy. It's like all these, like, disparate plot threads that just all end up in one big pile at the end. This is so funny. It's on AFI's top 100, I believe. And one of the funniest movies of the 30s, certainly. And I would put it up there as one of the funniest movies just ever. And it's so good.
Bringing Up Baby is 1938. Very, very old, and yet very, very good. It's interesting with Cary Grant. You get this and you get Arsenic and Old Lace. And I wonder if when we have conversations about comedians who become great dramatic actors, I wonder if we kind of need to talk about Cary Grant in that conversation, because really his early career was screwball comedy. And
he did His Girl Friday a couple years after this, and that's just like an Aaron Sorkin mm-hmm. fire hose of a script, yeah. which is really funny.
Yeah, and then he transitions into Hitchcock movies and right. doing some great stuff there. So, yeah, really interesting career there. Howard Hawks directed it, you know, very well-known director. Yeah, Bringing Up Baby is great. It is old, and old movies have, you know, old movie making.
I mean, I'm not speaking to you there. I mean, you and I do not have that baggage, and I think anyone that's seen more than a couple thousand movies has invariably gotten over that. But I know for a long time, I had the oldest movie I had seen up until I was like 25 years old was probably Wizard of Oz from, I think, the same year, 38. But I could count the number of 1920s and 30s movies I had seen on one hand. Mm-hmm. Until I was probably 25 or 26 years old.
Yeah.
And I made a deliberate decision then. I'm like, I really need to broaden, you know, temporally what I'm watching.
Yeah.
And I sought out movies that I had otherwise not even considered, watched a lot of silent movies. I've watched something like 45 movies last year that were made before 1925.
Yeah.
Just last year. And I really wanted to, like, expand my horizons. And I've been finding some great stuff.
There's a gift, you know, that as a film lover, you kind of have to remind yourself to tap into, which is film's been around for a while and people have been telling great stories for a while. You know, my list of shame has been legendary for how much Billy Wilder stuff is on it. I just never really watched the Billy Wilder stuff until this year. And now I can't get enough of it. And I'm just, you know, watching, you know, all this stuff. And it's, yeah, I think we need to remember as film lovers what a treasure we have, because a lot of times we think is the future as the treasure is like, oh, I can't wait to see what's coming out in the future. And the past can be just as exciting.
It is telling that there must be, you know, this podcast included, 1,000 people on YouTube this week talking about the Winter Soldier, the Falcon and the Winter Soldier. Probably 3 people have reviewed Bringing Up Baby in any long form worthy discussion. And that's, I don't want to say that's not great. But I would like to see that remedied, because I feel like so much of the discussion is on just comic books and new movies. And very rarely do we go back and appreciate the stuff we already have. And so much of it is brilliant.
Definitely had it in my honorable mentions. My number one best ever baby movie is the movie I stretched the category for the most. So if you want to veto it, you can. But I think Baby Jack-Jack is enough a part of The Incredibles to call The Incredibles my number one. It is a stretch. I don't know.
I'll allow it.
I don't know
close.
That you'd say it prominently features a baby, but I think he's a main character and some of the scenes are, you know, all about him. I don't know. It's a bit of a stretch, but that's
I know you love The Incredibles. That's one of your top 5 movies, right? Because I know Finding Nemo is your favorite Pixar.
Correct. Correct.
But this is like right next to that, right?
Yeah, it's in top 10 at least. I'd have to pull up the list. I kind of rearrange it every year, but yeah, it's definitely in the top 10.
Had I not second-guessed myself, Children of Men would have been my number one. I think all time, that's probably in my top 50 movies. Yeah. Again, probably my favorite movie from 2006. But yeah, Incredibles is a perfectly incredible pick. I will allow that. I don't think we need really to discuss much. I feel like you probably already have.
I probably talked about it. If we wanted to disallow it, everything would move up, and probably Bringing Up Baby would have been my number five. So
okay, well, there you go.
So there you go. Is how that would have worked.
What was your number two then?
Roma. Roma would have ended up being my number one.
That's a fine pick too.
Some others. Did you have any others you wanted to mention? Honorable mentions.
Whatever Happened to Baby Jane? Another great black and white play based drama. That's one of those movie, like acting the movies. It's just a performance of those two powerhouses. I remember really loving this when I watched it a few years ago, but I haven't seen it in a while. I don't remember enough other than just it's very good. And then a movie I watched recently, I've been working my way through the DCOMs, the Disney Channel original movies. And I got to Quince this week, which is a movie about a pair of quintuples. Not a great movie, not even a good movie. But it has five babies in it, and like right there, that's 500% more than the rest of these pictures.
That's right.
If we talk about a movie that prominently features babies, this one features five.
That's right. Can't get better than that.
It was a good background watch. It was perfectly affable, and I think if you're under 10, you'd like it.
I think if you want to have more baby than that, you're going to end up talking about Boss Baby, and nobody wants that. So we're not going there.
Gosh. Or another movie I watched recently in my effort to watch everything that's terrible is Baby Geniuses.
Oh, yeah.
And gosh, what a terrible... It's not as bad as Super Babies 2, Super Geniuses, whatever it's called, the sequel. But the first Baby Geniuses movie is really quite awful. And mostly not because of the dumb premise where babies are smart and we lose that intelligence as we get older, but that they insist on using CGI replacement on the baby's lips. Like in Look Who's Talking, Bruce Willis is voicing the baby, but the mouth doesn't move.
We just
hear it internalized like we do in many animal movies. We just hear the voice. In the Super Babies movies, they replace their lips, and it just looks so uncanny and looks so disturbing to see babies move and talk like a human. Like it's just so unnatural, and you hate it.
You hate to see it.
Easy to hate.
Let's see. Juno, I think probably deserves a mention. Dirty Dancing, possibly a mention in there.
Nobody puts baby in a corner.
Raising Arizona, I think, is a good one to bring up. Definitely a baby prominent.
I haven't seen that yet. That's actually near the. That's like probably top 20 on my list of shame. Actually,
okay, fair enough. Let's see. Rosemary's Baby. Someone mentioned in the chat.
I hated that. We'll put that next to Quince and Super Babies as my dishonorable mentions.
And then a couple that are a bit of a stretch, but I do think the babies fit fairly prominently in there. Into the Woods and Neighbors both have babies.
Neighbors definitely. Into the Woods, I guess. Yeah.
I mean, it's about having a baby and trying to do that. Anyways. There you go.
I didn't love the movie though. So
I did, but I'm a musical guy. Oh yeah, I like loved it. Yeah, I really liked Into the Woods.
Well, good for you. That's good.
Let's see, best ever baby movies. If you can think of any, let us know. We will now get into our buried treasure. What's that one thing in any area of pop culture you want to make sure people know about? Jonathan is our guest. You get to go last, so I will kick us off. Kind of going on the same thing we were talking about with appreciating different eras of film and the treasure that is the past. I went on an accidental binge of Mutiny on the Bounty movies. I watched all three Mutiny on the Bounty movies this weekend.
Aren't there like five?
No. Well, not that I know of. I just knew of the three. There was 1935.
The one with Charles Langford and
Lawton. I think it was Lawton and Gable.
And Gable. Mm-hmm. Clark Gable. And then the 50s one with
'50s one with 62 was Brando.
Okay, that's the last one. Okay, 62 with Brando and then 85 with Mel Gibson, right?
Correct. Yeah, 84, I think. Yeah, with Mel Gibson and Anthony Hopkins as Bly, as Captain Bly. Now, I will tell you, I knew a little bit about this story. It's a pretty famous story. And I found this process of watching these three movies back to back to back so fascinating. I think you can learn a lot about different styles of storytelling, how changing the emphasis of a story completely changes the movie. This is a really great week of like film school. If you want to like learn stuff about movie making, even just the different eras, like, and we're due, right? You've got the 30s, the 60s, the 80s. Like, we're due for another Mutiny on the Bounty movie.
Maybe that's why I thought there was a fourth one, but I could be mixing it up with a Robin Hood has had like 100.
Sure, sure, yeah.
And but I know we've had one recently. I thought there was a Mutiny on the Bounty that came out in the last 5 years, but I guess not.
I would recommend them all for different reasons. I liked the Bounty the least. I liked the Mel Gibson,
that's
Anthony Hopkins.
That's the 80s one, right?
Yeah, one the least. And
I've only seen the first, and I've seen the original from 35 and the 84. And I love the Clark Gable one. That film is absolutely phenomenal.
So here's the thing. That is an Oscar-winning film. The one in 62 was nominated for a bunch of stuff and does have Brando in it. I actually watched 62 first. It was just kind of in my line of movies to watch. This is how I accidentally stumbled into this. Realized I hadn't watched the 35 version, so I watched that next. And I was like, well, I might as well, you know, knock the 84 version off too and watch that. I think the 62 version has a lot to like about it, especially the first half of the movie. I think it is the best mutiny scene of the three. I think the way they decide to set that event is better than the other two. They set it in a daylight moment where things are building to a crescendo, and then Brando's just had enough, and he goes for it. In the 84 version, it happens at night. And they do a sneak attack, and, you know, and I forget, actually, the 35 mutiny part is really just kind of almost matter of fact. The whole mutiny thing is just like, okay, it's time, I'm doing this, and it just kind of happens. So, you know, that was really interesting to see. The second half of the 62 version is not great. Brando gets really into, like, this moody version of the Christian Fletcher character, where it really becomes all about Christian Fletcher, just like solely about he's all bummed out. At the end, he decides we're going back to England. We're going to convince them that Bly is the reason this happened. And if they hang us, they hang us, but we need to go back. His men burn the boat behind his back and to keep them from going back to England. To do that, which is completely different than the other two movies play this. Now,
I think it's also historically inaccurate as well.
Well, there's a lot unknown historically, right? Like, this happened, you know, so far ago, and there are different reports. What's interesting is the main thing. I could probably talk about this for half an hour. I had so much
fun. I'm enjoying
it. No, I'm
so fascinated by the Bounty story, honestly.
I had so much fun thinking about this. Historians will talk about this event as being the primary event that led to a better relationship between superiors and crewmen on their vessels. This was like, okay, we need to do something about this. We need to be able for it not to be so contentious between crew and so it's interesting to see how each of these three movies play with that. The Bounty doesn't even touch on it. Like, it doesn't even care about that, which I find really interesting, since that seems to what it's about. The thing about the 35 that makes it so great is the last half. That is it's a court battle. The last half of the first Mutiny on the Bounty is about who was in the right and who was, you know, in. Well, Christian Fletcher's not there because he's off on the Pitcairn Islands or whatever, or disappears somewhere. But one of the crewmen is there to plead his own case against Bly, loses that court battle, but then gets, I think, the king. Commutes the sentence or whatever the case may be, and he ends up working on boats again. The Bly character is an absolute villain in 35 and 62 and is the hero of the movie in 84. Bly is absolutely 100% the hero of that movie. It ends with him with a single tear coming down his face as he's acquitted, because he did nothing wrong, and it was really all Christian Fletcher just being lovesick for the native island and their time on Tahiti, that just lost his mind because he was so in love with the girl on Tahiti. And that is nowhere in 62 or 35. It's just so interesting that I don't mean that the Tahiti stuff isn't in those movies. It is, but that's not. But Christian Fletcher is trying to stand up against a And this, by all means, is historical. A captain who was absolutely awful to his crew. In the 35 and the 62, you have examples of him telling people to steal things and then making them take the lashes for stealing them, right? Like, that story is in both of those movies. You have keel hauling in both of those movies, which is this terrible torture where you make somebody drag them under the ship, you know?
I remember that being...
None of that is in the Bounty. He does none of those things. He's a great captain who's a little bit stern, but Christian Fletcher can't handle it. And I find that so interesting to see how differently these movies are handled.
I do this occasionally where I'll watch a movie that has an updated version. I remember watching A Perfect Murder right after Dial M for Murder. Mm-hmm. And it's so interesting to see the modern adaptation of an old black and white film. A few years back on YouTube, I reviewed a bunch of Dracula movies, from Nosferatu to the 33 version with Bela Lugosi to the 58 version from Hammer Films to a weird one from Herzog in the 70s to what's his name? The big budget one with Keanu Reeves in the 90s. And it was so interesting to see that same character interpreted in wildly different ways.
Mm-hmm.
And watching different adaptations of the same thing is, I think, the closest you can get without reading a book to having that sensation of what you get when you read a book before seeing a movie. And you have your own ideas and your own concept of what you want the plot to do and where you're expecting it to go, because you already know the story. And then seeing it play out in a different way. And I watched both the Monte Cristos back to back last fall. The one from the 30s and then the one with Jim Caviezel in, I think 2002. And that was the same thing, where I loved both of them for very different reasons.
Yeah.
And I really loved the original, but then the new one is like, well, this by all accounts updated and fixed everything I didn't like, so why don't I like it as much? And you kind of have to figure out, like, what about each movie did each part best? And you kind of said it yourself. Like, you love the beginning of one and the half of the other.
I'll take the first half of 62. The second half of 35 and 84 can go sit in a corner.
Yeah. But it's so fascinating that you kind of, in your own headcanon, put together like this Frankenstein of a movie. Like, I wish this existed, because this is my favorite part of all three.
Yeah.
And you can kind of slalom between it and get to a point that is, you know, satisfactory. But that's cool that you went back and watched all three in 1 week. I've seen them years apart, and I don't think I've ever seen the 62 one yet.
So, yeah, I would say it's definitely worth watching for kind of that, just the fascination of storytelling and how it changes. Again, I would absolutely say see the 35, see the 62. You don't need to see the 84 if you don't want to. A lot more nudity in the 84, that's for sure. They were much more careful with the island women in the 35 and the 62 than they were in the 84. So that was also an interesting, you know, kind of going to the 80s aesthetic like that. I think if they made the version now, it would be much more about imperialism and just the idea of, you know, taking this breadfruit from Tahiti in the first place. Like, none of that is in any of these three versions. The idea that, you know, the English...
what they were doing was totally wrong.
Well, at least morally questionable. You know, at least have some question about it. But no, it's very much, you know, from that perspective. So that would be the version that gets made now, is the version that takes more into account the indigenous people of Tahiti and those, you know, Mutiny on the Bounty from the Tahitian point of view. Like, that's... I don't know. Maybe it's there. I don't know. So... yeah, interesting.
What if it and Moana exist in the same universe?
Well, there you go. Who knows? Could be.
One really cool thing before we move off on this. I went down a rabbit hole years ago when I first watched the 35 version. Not only are the settlers on Pitcairn Island still around and thriving, the Fletcher family name lives on today. And
he
has a website and he has photographs. Christian Fletcher's like five times great-grandson. Is alive. Well, he's our age. He has a website. He does photography up at Karen Island, and you can buy paintings of his and stuff.
Yeah.
And that's wild to me. That, like, this character that Mel Gibson played is alive, or his grandson is alive and well on this island.
Well, and it was an uninhabited island when they hid there.
Yeah.
You know?
And they're still, they still exist. The Bounty wreckage is still in the bay of this island today. You can see it on Google Earth. You can zoom in and see the wreckage. It's still there. 150, 60 years, whatever, later.
It's amazing. What do you got in your buried treasure, Jonathan?
Completely different style of movie. I'm going with Tiny Toon Adventures, How I Spent My Vacation.
Oh, okay.
Which has the distinction of being the first direct-to-video feature-length animated film in U.S. history. which surprised me. I watched it when it came out, released in 1992. And it's sort of an amalgamation of the old Tiny Toon Adventures TV show. It takes all these characters, Bugs and Buster Bunny and Plucky Duck and Ham Pig, and it puts them in separate but parallel plots, which is kind of the only way you can stretch like a Tiny Toon Adventure format to 80 minutes, is no one plot thread is longer than like 20. But they're all happening simultaneously. And the reason I went back and revisited this for the first time in 30 years is because there's a joke in there where Plucky mentions that at this rate, we won't get to Happy World Land, this Disney World analog. And he pulls out the map, does this calculation, one of those long jokes where he's like, I'm going to carry the one, da 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 da. We'll be there on April 6, 2021. So in accordance with that joke, I watched it on April 6th.
Nice.
I had probably seen this movie 15 or 20 times as a kid. And it was so fascinating to go back to a movie that I have not seen in close to three full decades. And everything in this movie I remembered and didn't simultaneously, if that makes any sense. I could not remember a single minute of this film when I started it, but every single joke was like, oh my gosh, that's where that is. Like, like so much of this was like outside the boundary of my memory, but it was right there. And as soon as the joke happened, I remembered it instantly. And there was something really fascinating about going back and watching a childhood favorite that I haven't seen in so long. And seeing how it holds up, how much of that influenced my comedy and my sensibilities as like a seven-year-old.
Yeah.
And it holds up. It was still really funny. There was a lot of really good jokes. And so much of the adult humor here I completely missed as a kid. There's long extended gags involving talk show hosts like David Letterman and Jay Leno. And I'm like, I would not have got this at 7 years old. But as an adult, I really appreciated this joke where they have Roseanne Barr fall off a balcony. Like, that was funny. and it was this kind of thing like, this was in a kid's movie? I liked this? It was a trip. So my advice would be not necessarily this movie, but find that picture that you remember loving as a kid, the VHS or the DVD you wore out as a child.
Yeah.
Get your hands, especially if you haven't seen it at all since. And certainly I grew up on a lot of the old Disney classics like Aladdin, but I had watched those before and since. But find a movie you haven't, the longest time you can remember between when you last watched it and today, and give that a revisit. It was a fun experience.
Escape from Witch Mountain. I had that experience with Apple Dumpling Gang, Tim Conway. You know, a lot of this stuff, by the way, is on Disney Plus. Like, this is a treasure trove of that kind of stuff for you. Flight of the Navigator was like that for me a little bit. Like, you're right. You like remember bits and pieces, but not really a lot. And then you watch it and you're like, oh no, I know every single joke in this.
movie. As the jokes were happening, I'm like, oh my gosh, yes. I remember this. I remember the line. I remember the intonation of the delivery.
Yeah, totally.
But like second to second, I was remembering it in real time. But a minute before that, I had no idea what would happen next.
Yeah.
And it was kind of great. It was really cool.
Nice. Very fun. Well, we did it, man. We did a podcast. We accomplished what we set out to do. We may not have gotten breadfruit to bring back to England, but we did.
We talked for 90 minutes.
We did. We talked.
We're winners.
Thank you so much for joining us today. Sif Pop is part of the Studio DNA Podcast Network. You can find out more about other shows on the network at studiodna.media or by searching Studio DNA in your podcast player. Huge thanks to producer Phil for producing the audio and video show today. Appreciate you, Phil. Thanks to Drew for putting together some of the content for the show today. Big clap, I think is what Andrew says. And thank you to Jonathan, Paula for hanging out. Where do you want to send people? What do you want to tell them about Jonathan Paula Industries?
Again, every time you ask me this, I'm always so ashamed that I haven't done anything except this podcast. but I have been very active on Letterboxd lately. I wrote something like 8 reviews in 8 days. And these are like long 600-word reviews. So I don't know, proud is probably too strong a word, but I'm really glad that I'm trying to shake off some of that rust and get more into a critical awareness of what I've been watching. Wrote a long, long write-up on The Passion of the Christ on Easter. So yeah, check me out on letterboxd.com/JonPaula, John Paula. And I'm also reviewing a bunch of Disney Channel original movies as I watch all 106 of those this year.
Ah.
I am up to the year 2000, where Disney, I kid you not, released something like 16 movies in a single year.
Wow.
Why? I don't know why. That's every 3 weeks. Cool it, guys. So I'm only at 2000, but I've watched at least 12 or 13 now, and none of them are good.
There you go.
Absolutely there zero go. Have been good.
Also want to thank our SIFPOP members for giving monthly to make SIFPOP a real thing. Support starts at $3 a month. $5 a month gets you access to every bonus episode as well. So check out all the levels, the perks, all that fun stuff at patreon.com/SIFPOP. Lots of ways to connect with us. Feel free to comment, rate, or leave a review at Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen. And you can email us as well, feedback@SIFPOP.com. And finally, if you're having a good time, your movie-loving friends will probably like the show too, so make sure you let them know about it and that listening is much easier than burning yourself with Sheila's lukewarm coffee. We will be back next week with the Oscar show, but it will be video only. Your podcast feed will be empty, but please tune in to the show on YouTube, Twitch, anywhere else that you can follow the SIFPOP show video. We'll be doing that next week, and then we'll be back in 2 weeks on the podcast with some more fun stuff, probably including Mortal Kombat. So we will see you then.
Bye.
Bye.